Welcome to the Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Craig Agyul about some of the philosophical issues related to mens rea requirements and also the connection between mens rea and free will.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Craig Agyul, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University, Camden. Craig works on issues in the philosophy of law and moral psychology, and is especially interested in issues about moral and legal responsibility, and also the normative conditions of blame and punishment. He's published several articles and a book chapter on these and related issues, and today he's graciously agreed to come on our show to tell us about the philosophical issues surrounding mens rea requirements in the law. So welcome to the show, Craig. Can you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on issues related to free will, responsibility in the law?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love this podcast, and I'm thrilled to participate. Bit of an intellectual wanderer. At one point, I was a coder for a State Department subcontractor. I've studied economics. I was a practicing commercial litigator. And then finally, I got my PhD in philosophy at the University of California of San Diego, where I spent many hours running and talking philosophy with episode 55's Per Erik Milam. I hope you forgive that cross-reference.
Yeah.
At UCSD, I was interested in the intersection between law and philosophy, and so I worked with David Brink and Dana Nelkin there. Mm-hmm. Given their interests and my interests, I felt compelled, perhaps ironically, to work on moral and legal responsibility. Right. And you can't work on those issues without also being interested in agential freedom. So that's the path.
That's great.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, for someone who's never heard the term before, what is mens rea? And maybe you could contrast this with actus reus.
So criminal law theorists generally distinguish between the actus reus and the mens rea of a crime. Joshua Dressler wrote a very famous study guide familiar to first-year law students everywhere. And in that guide, Dressler describes actus reus and mens rea this way. The actus reus is the physical or external portion of the crime, and the mens rea is the mental or internal feature. I like to think that mens rea is what's inside my skull. The actus reus is everything else. Now, exactly what the boundary is between the external and the internal is a site of rich debate, as is whether this is a distinction worth having. If you've got questions about the categorization, welcome to the club. But we can distinguish them intuitively. So think of an assault and battery. We can distinguish between the motion of the fist and the purposeful intention to punch, the former being the actus reus and the latter being the mens rea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm sure this varies across times and jurisdictions, but could you give some examples of crimes where mens rea is crucial and maybe also some examples of strict liability crimes which don't have mens rea requirements?
Yeah. So let me start with an example from New Jersey where I teach. In New Jersey, theft by unlawful taking is defined this way. A person is guilty of theft if he unlawfully takes or exercises unlawful control over movable property of another with purpose to deprive him thereof. You can see the actus reus there, the taking or exercise of control. Mm-hmm. And then there's the mens rea. You only commit this crime of theft if you have a particular purpose in mind, the purpose to deprive the property owner of the object. Yeah. If you pick up my bike and move it in order to get to your bike behind it, you have exercised control over my bike, but not with the purpose to deprive me of it. No unlawful taking. Or if you know that I'm looking for my bike and you remember that you saw it leaning against the school and you take it and bring it to me, yes, you controlled it, but not with the purpose of depriving me of it. No unlawful taking. In both cases, what gets you off of the New Jersey criminal law hook is your mental state. You lack the requisite mens rea. So we can raise the stakes now. In New Jersey, you commit murder if you purposefully or knowingly cause death or serious bodily injury resulting in death. Mm-hmm. By contrast, in New Jersey, you commit manslaughter if you recklessly cause death under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life. The key difference between murder and manslaughter is your mental state. Was death your purpose? Did you know that death would result? Then you have committed murder. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you knew that your behavior was risky and that death was a possible result, then you have committed manslaughter. So in both the theft case and the homicide cases, New Jersey cares a lot about defendants' mental states.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, you also asked about strict liability offenses.
Mm-hmm.
Strict liability offenses are offenses where no mental state is required for at least one element of the crime. Many of us are unfortunately familiar with strict liability offenses. Many driving and parking offenses require no particular mental state. I might have been totally innocent in leaving my car parked beyond the 2-hour limit, distracted by philosophy, but they will still get me for $60.
Yeah.
Likewise, a number of federal statutes have strict liability elements. So consider, this is not legal advice, but consider the federal criminal provision regarding the theft of livestock. Whoever obtains or uses the property of another in connection with the marketing of livestock in interstate or foreign commerce with the intent to deprive the other of a right to the property shall be fined under this title or imprisoned. Here, there is a mens rea requirement as to the theft piece. It's familiar from our look at New Jersey law. Mm-hmm. But there's no mens rea requirement as to the interstate or foreign commerce piece. You knowingly steal my prized Brahmin bull in Camden, New Jersey, you're on the hook for New Jersey theft. Mm-hmm. You unknowingly cross into Pennsylvania on your getaway, and now you're on the hook for the federal crime. There is no mental state required for that particular jurisdictional element. That's the strict liability. And this is a key criminal law lesson. When we're analyzing mens rea, mental states apply to elements of crimes. Much criminal law litigation is sorting out exactly which elements go with which mental states. And the need to tie mental states to particular elements can often explain the artificial phrasing we find in criminal statutes.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So can mens rea come in degrees? And what does this look like in criminal law, especially when it comes to responding to criminal behavior?
So, we saw a bit of this in New Jersey's homicide laws. Criminal law theorists often distinguish between 5 different mens rea categories. An agent might act purposefully, knowingly, recklessly, or negligently, or we might impose strict liability. So an agent acts purposefully when the element is their conscious object. I intend to kill. That's my purpose. An agent acts knowingly when they are aware of the element. I take a bike knowing that it's yours, even though I don't care whose bike it is, and I would even be fine were it my own bike. I just want to ride a bike. But I know it's yours. An agent acts recklessly when they are aware of the risk of the element, but act anyway. I speed through the school zone, knowing that it is the end of school and children might well be running through the street. An agent acts negligently when they are not aware of the risk of the element, but should have been. I thoughtlessly pour my used motor oil into the drain, not realizing that the drain goes straight into a protected watershed, and I don't notice or even bother to read the warning signs. And then strict liability, of course, requires nothing of our minds. And very often, the more demanding mens rea levels are tied to more culpable crimes, as we see in New Jersey's homicide law. Purposeful killing is worse than negligent killing, though both are certainly bad.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, there's a recent case here in California that was a case of strict liability when it came to harvesting shellfish. So is a lot of these strict liability kind of crimes have to do with things like that? Like, because it was something similar to the livestock case.
So there are, in general, 3 big categories or 3 categories of strict liability crime. One is that the crime is fairly low level. So that's the parking where we are not that worried about, the occasional innocent person who gets punished. And we don't want to burden the criminal law system with proving mens rea. So you can imagine how many people would fight parking tickets if they could plead, not guilty by reason of insanity. So sometimes we get strict liability for that reason. Other times we get strict liability because we think the crime is so terrible that we just really are more worried about people escaping than about guilty people getting away with things than innocent people. That might be a rationale for the statutory rape example. Oh, yeah. So statutory rape's often an example of strict liability. And then the third thing, the third category is where the bit of culpability, like the behavior is wrong in general. So stealing cattle is wrong in general, but we have some jurisdictional element or there's some administrative or procedural reason that we need to distinguish this kind of crime from other crimes. So, you know, if you've spent any time with the Constitution, there's the federal government's powers are limited to interstate matters. And so that's why the federal crime requires the aspect of interstate commerce. But that's about the federal government's powers, not about the it's not any worse for you to smuggle my stolen cow into northern New Jersey than it is for you to smuggle my stolen cow into Pennsylvania. But right. The strict liability element helps determine which courts it goes to. So okay. I suspect the shellfish is going to be something like that, where there is a mens rea element for some bit of it, but then there's a particular bit of it that that is more administrative in purpose.
Yeah, it seemed more like the parking ticket, because the game warden just gave the person who harvested illegally a ticket.
Right, right.
They didn't have to go to jail or anything like that.
Yeah. So for tickets and infractions, often there's no mens rea. That's mm-hmm. pretty common.
Makes sense.
Even though, I mean, I've got to be clear, all of my parking tickets were purposeful. I should have been on the hook for that. I wanted that 2 hours and 15 minutes. That was, I didn't have anywhere to go. I just sat in the car.
You weren't even doing philosophy. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. We want to ask you next about the connection between the mens rea requirement in criminal law and the subject of our podcast, namely free will. As I was thinking about questions for the interview, I came across an interesting line from a United States Supreme Court decision in 1952 from Morissette v. United States, which reads, "The contention that an injury can amount to a crime only when inflicted by intention is no provincial or transient notion. It is as universal and persistent in mature systems of law as belief in freedom of the human will and a consequent ability and duty of the normal individual to choose between good and evil." That's the end of the quote. I take it that the idea is not simply that, like, the mens rea requirement and belief in free will both happen to be universal and persistent, but there's some connection between them. So do you think there are connections between mens rea and free will?
Absolutely. As critics of strict liability and even negligence liability point out, if we're not aware that we're about to do wrong, it can seem unfair to ask us to change our plans.
Yeah.
So the law gives us reasons. Don't steal, don't murder, don't transport someone else's livestock across state lines. And the law demands that we respond to those reasons, and it punishes us when we fail to do so. But in order to successfully respond to those reasons, we have to have the relevant agential capacities. We have to be able to recognize the reasons, and we have to be able to respond to the reasons we recognize. And so the free will theorists, the moral responsibility theorists, and the criminal law theorists all share an interest in the nature of reasons responsiveness.
Yeah.
Taylor, you teach in Alabama. We can see the criminal law's interest in reasons responsiveness in Alabama's insanity defense, which is a fairly typical insanity defense. In Alabama, the insanity defense is available when a defendant has a severe mental disease or defect that leaves them unable to appreciate the nature and quality or wrongfulness of his acts. This is an incapacity defense. The defendant lacks an ability. And its language is familiar for those of us in the reasons responsiveness literature. And the interest here in fairness as a limiting constraint on punishment is shared between the criminal law and the free will theorists. Now, on the other hand, criminal law theorists seem less concerned with questions regarding determinism and fate. Mm-hmm. While the American criminal law grapples with coercion, with mental health conditions, in ways that will be familiar to those in the free will debate, those conditions are seen by the criminal law and the criminal law theorists as exceptions to the usual rule. The criminal law's commitment to the fact of ordinary responsibility is pretty dogged. And there are exceptions. Greg Caruso has skillfully taken up the skeptical line, but they are exceptions, and they tend to be philosophers, not legal theorists, and certainly not legal practitioners.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what are some of the ongoing debates about mens rea requirements in the criminal law?
there are a lot of exciting ongoing debates. And so I'm going to mention just a handful. I'm going to start with something that I've weighed in on. A substantial minority of criminal law theorists have rejected negligence liability. So they say it's constitutive of negligence that you don't know what you're doing. You don't know that it's wrong. And they argue it's unfair to hold people to account for something that they don't know about. We can only control what we know about. Control is necessary for liability, they argue. Now, I'm on the other side of that debate. I say negligence is culpable, but that is an ongoing and lively debate. Second, you might have noticed when I talked about Alabama's insanity defense that it includes only a cognitive element. You have an excuse if you lack the capacity to know what you're doing or to appreciate its wrongfulness. But free will theorists are also interested, and maybe even more interested, in the volitional element. Do you have the capacity to act on it? And there's a rich and ongoing debate about whether the criminal law should recognize a volitional element. So my very first day of law school, very first class, was with Stephen Morse, and he's a famous skeptic of the volitional element. So he says, just cognitive stuff, no volitional stuff. Then there are cases where we're going to hold people culpable for one kind of mens rea, even though they don't quite have it. So transferred intent is one of these sorts of cases. Adam shoots at Ben, intending to kill Ben. Ben ducks. The bullet strikes Carla and kills her. Adam intended to kill. Adam did kill, but Adam did not enact his intention. So we've got to decide, is Adam guilty of purposeful homicide, of reckless homicide? What is he? What is he guilty of?
Yeah.
Or more famously, maybe more controversially, the felony murder rule. New Jersey, most states have a felony murder rule. So the three of us, I guess very publicly now, plot and then go commit a bank robbery. And during our bank robbery, I shoot and kill the bank teller. You too could be on the hook for an intentional or knowing murder, even though neither of you intended to kill anyone, neither of you tried to kill anyone, and neither of you expected anyone to get killed. You thought this is just a, you know, nice old-fashioned bank robbery. Mm-hmm. The fact that you intentionally, so you did do something intentionally, you intentionally participated in the bank robbery. And the fact that you intentionally participated in a dangerous crime is enough for intentional murder, effectively, under the felony murder rule. And we can ask, is it fair to hold you two on the hook for the same sort of murder I would be on the hook for? And then a fourth area that's lively right now, what about the savvy defendant who knows the criminal law and so who acts to block mens rea? Our bank robbery plan didn't work out so great, so we start a cattle smuggling gang. Whenever we hire someone to bring our stolen livestock across the border, we make sure not to tell them what is in the back of the truck, and they make sure not to ask. When a driver gets caught, have they knowingly committed a smuggling crime? Of course, everyone knows that something fishy is going on, but none of the drivers ever saw any cattle or were told about any cattle. For all they knew, they could have been transporting produce or cigarettes or family heirlooms. The law grapples with cases like this, and so we see a debate about what's called culpable ignorance. Those are some of the debates that are lively right now.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about that last thing, culpable ignorance, when you were talking about, negligence and whether, ignorance is an excuse. Do you think, there's this saying that like ignorance of the law is no excuse, but I wonder what you think about cases where someone couldn't have reasonably been expected to know the details of a particular law. It's not common knowledge. What do you think are some of the issues around that?
So I think, in fact, despite the saying is good, but it's not legal advice.
Right.
Ignorance of the law sometimes is an excuse. And as a rough proxy to tell whether ignorance of the law is an excuse, you can think about morality. So, we move to New York State, and we haven't looked up New York State's laws. And so, in fact, we don't know whether murder is illegal in New York State. Maybe New York State is, it's a very natural state, so maybe it's the state of nature. I don't know. still, because murder is so morally abhorrent, we're on notice that we might get in trouble for murder. So there, the reason why ignorance is not an excuse is because morality is what's giving us some notice that we could get in trouble.
Yeah.
By contrast, So, we talked, I forget the type of fish, but we talked about a person who gets a citation for fishing. If we go to Wyoming, we might not know of a particular weight limit on fishing. And so in cases where the law is particularly administrative or regulatory, their ignorance sometimes is an excuse. Mm-hmm. Although you're, sometimes required to get legal counsel and the like. But you will see cases where ignorance is an excuse. And the dividing question is whether the law expects you to have known the law. The law expects you to know, you can't drive recklessly with your eyes closed, regardless of whether you've studied the statutes. The law does not expect you always to know the difference between, this and that kind of cable in your home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got a follow-up question about the insanity law in Alabama. So Alabama has the particular kind where it's about knowing the ability to know certain things about right and wrong. Are there other cases in other states or the definitions of insanity in other states that do incorporate the volitional element?
So there are sort of three popular ways to set up insanity. One is Alabama style. Then there is a document that's not law called the Model Penal Code. And the Model Penal Code it is just what it sounds like. Experts get together and they write the ideal. And a lot of jurisdictions will either track that or use bits of it. And there you do get some appeal to the volitional element. But there's a third way of going, which is where you say, look, I don't know how we're going to litigate capacity. Like, I don't know how in a criminal trial we prove that someone had an ability. We would call some philosophers, but they've been going at this for thousands of years. And So sometimes jurisdictions will say, the philosophers don't have an answer, but the psychiatrists and the psychologists do. So you have an insanity defense if you have a condition. So you just have to prove the condition, and then let's sort of defer to the mental health folks to figure out which conditions. So you do get, I think that the deference to the mental health folks is far less popular now, like basically gone now. But there are those three models that get kind of considered.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Those are all really fascinating issues, Craig. Are there any others that you'd want to mention? Any other questions about mens rea that people still are talking about?
So there is, I'm not involved in this, but there is an interesting discussion about, there's a worry that giving people a mens rea defense, like insanity, is disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see this sometimes from disability communities where they'll say, look, it's true that this condition, descriptively might have this or that effect, but you're effectively saying someone with this condition is not a full member of the, legal community.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Craig. This has been fascinating. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have. If people that are listening want to go and read something of yours or get to know you or your work more, where can they go to follow your work?
Well, so they should come say hi in Camden, New Jersey. As I tell my students, my office hours are on Wednesday afternoons. Just say hello, I'm there. Hopefully it's effective this time. Somebody's got to say hi to me. Or you can find me at craigkagule.com. You can find me on Phil Papers, or I'd love to hear from listeners at craig.agule@rutgers.edu.
Nice. Excellent. Yeah, thanks again, Craig.
Thank you guys so much. This has been fun.
You're welcome.
Our next episode will be on moral authority and punishment, and our guest will be Victor Tadros, professor of criminal law and legal theory at the University of Warwick.